From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
All the self-help books you can ever read will tell you that you need to add value to people, and I feel like we're actually doing that, whereas in the past I just thought we were giving a good service but maybe not adding value.
I'm Conor Carney, and that's the voice of Hugh O'Moran, founder and CEO of Float, a company that provides ticketing software to sports stadiums around the globe. Hugh started out in business back in 2002 at the tender age of 21, launching Ireland's very first ice skating rink in the IFSC. In this conversation, Hugh talks about how he gained credibility as a young entrepreneur, using the Sunday Times Rich List as a way of raising money, building a global software business, and much, much more. Hugh started off our chat by explaining how he turned a college project into an international business.
Yeah, I suppose two things. When I finished in UCD, I went down to Smurfit Business School to do a Master's in Entrepreneurial Studies. And one of the things that you had to do as part of that degree was to, they had a course in business planning and you had to do your own business plan. That same year, I had gone away on a trip to Switzerland. And when I was on that trip, I had gone ice skating. And I, to be honest, I'd never been ice skating before. Thought it was good fun. So I said when we got home that I'd go again, only to discover that in 2001, Ireland had no ice skating rinks whatsoever anywhere in the country. So I was like, that might be a good fit for the business plan. Basically, for the college project, I did that as my business plan. They actually ended up failing the business plan. And because I'm really stubborn, I said I would do it in real life to prove them wrong.
So you went to Smurfit to study entrepreneurship. So it was obviously something that was of interest to you prior to going.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, you know, prior to that, it was weird from a very young age. I don't know whether it was pirate radio or what, but I was always into sort of music. And when I was younger, I used DJ for, you know, like friends' birthday parties and that kind of thing. Then when we were around 15 or 16, myself and some of the guys in just near where I grew up, we set up a little community radio station. So we did DJing. We had set up a, like, we were 15 or 16 years old, and we did the radio station. Off the back of doing the radio station, we got asked to DJ for like teenage discos in the local youth club. And then as I got into college, there was more. I started, you know, there was the UCD Entertainment's office, and I was organizing gigging. But then, you know, I finished college. I was 21 and kind of felt if I was going to do that kind of event management type work, I needed maybe some more of a grounding in business and that kind of thing. So that was the, but yeah, I'd always been entrepreneurial since I've contracts from when I was 14 years old, renting DJ equipment to friends and this kind of thing. So yeah, I think I was definitely always entrepreneurial.
Did you ever consider getting a job directly out of college, or as I'm sure a lot of your friends were doing at the time?
I've never had, like, I'm 41 now, I've never had a traditional job. I was straight from college into that. It's funny, I was just speaking my wife earlier was thinking, should I get a real job now for the second half of my life?
So you had done the business planning, you'd been through that process in Smurfit, you'd seen the ice skating rink. Smurfit, whoever your professor was, wasn't too happy with it, and you decided, well, I'll go do it. Was that straight away when you finished Smurfit?
To be honest, I was still in Smurfit when I started the initial fundraising and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, no, and then the college course finished up and I just kept running with it.
Was it difficult to start?
I don't think it was difficult to start, but I think it was difficult to, how would I say, to maybe taken seriously as a 21-year-old with a project of that scale. And to that end, I started, my uncle is Conal O'Moran, he was involved in PR at the time. So I started working with him a little bit more closely, and he, you know, he'd kind of come with me to some of the meetings to kind of add a little bit of gravitas to that. That was the only kind of challenge at that age.
How did you go about it? Did you have investors? I'm sure it wasn't inexpensive to start an ice skating rink.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I saw on the news or on Twitter this morning, people were giving out some show on RTE about the Irish Rich List or something. But I thought it was inappropriate that it be shown during COVID times. But every year the Sunday Times do this Rich List cutout. So I literally got that. I just started ringing people from the top of the list. And eventually got someone who I shall remain nameless, but was on that list to put, you know, who kind of said, look, that sounds like an interesting idea. Come and we'll have a chat. And it was literally as laissez-faire as that. So yeah, then a lot of the stuff had to be brought in from overseas and got stuck into Google and started looking, you know, where can you get an ice rink? And, you know, what else do you need? Speakers. And I traveled around a lot. You know, there'd never been an ice rink in Ireland, but there was good examples all over, you know, in other cities around the world. So I traveled around to see. There's a very well-known one in Somerset House in London. I went to see that. There's a nice one in Vienna in Austria. So I kind of traveled around and kind of just looked at the way you said, look, let's take the best of all these elements and put them together and see if we can do something at home. And that's how all that got started.
So where did the ice rink end up being?
So in the IFSC, there's a hotel that was called the Clarion Hotel. It's got a new name now, right next door to that. On the name of the street is Excise Walk. So it was in there. We sold 70,000 tickets. It was pretty much sold out. To be honest, that's kind of how the kind of latter businesses that I ran got started. It was €7 for a kid to go ice skating. At the time, again, there was only one ticketing company in the country, which was Ticketmaster. And I think they wanted, so I can't remember now, it was a long time ago, but they wanted something in the region of €5 for every €7 ticket. We sold the tickets ourselves. And what kind of transpired is that ice rinks are difficult to make a profit from, but the ticketing was of interest. And out of that, we kind of, you know, what kind of followed was that we kind of got into the ticketing business and spent about 15 years in that space.
Sometimes when people start things, they tend to get a bit tied to their idea or it's kind of their secret as such that they went, you know, so the ice rink might be a good example for you. You went and started an ice rink. Pretty soon you kind of changed tack to go to a, you know, ticketing software business. Was there anything there kind of holding you back, or was it a simple decision to say, well, actually, I think this would be a better business overall?
I think the main thing was I was so young at the time. I got a huge amount of media attention. I was on the Marion Finucane show, and it was TV, front covers and newspapers. Funny enough, we got a whole bunch of calls. I know I was looking through your podcast listing, and I saw you had Mick Dawson on one time. I got a phone call from Mick Dawson from various other Dublin places saying, look, we also find Ticketmaster too expensive. Would you have any interest in helping us? And we were like, we're just a fella in a room. We've no it isn't really a system. But then, you know, the ice rink is very much a seasonal thing. It ended in January. We're like, okay, well, what will we do next? The interest, as you said, there was a lot of interest in that. So we called people back and said, look, we didn't have a system, but if we developed something, and people were. So at the time, we called the business Ticket Lord, which was supposed to be a direct competitor with Ticketmaster. We grew that out. We became the second largest player here in the Irish market. Then we met 2-3 years later, then we pushed over into the UK, you know, could just continued gradually growing that out until we were in about 14, maybe 17 countries.
Did you ever have any doubts, you know, as a young person trying to kind of build these businesses? A lot of things just seem to have come quite naturally to you, getting the right people on board and so on and so forth. I mean, was it ever difficult in the early days?
If I have a weakness, it's that I've always been really focused on making things profitable. Everything I've always run has always been profitable, whereas what I've seen over the last 10 years, and maybe this was a weakness, if you like, was that a lot of businesses seem to take in a lot of upfront venture capital money or startup funding, and for a long time they lose money now. But ultimately, they become bigger companies. They've got that capacity to grow. And I think possibly I didn't take the people on. I tried to do everything myself and work with smaller teams. And maybe we'd have been more successful more quickly if we had taken in a larger amount of investment, giving up some control, and I kind of let my grip off the thing a bit. So
in and around that time, you would have had the dot-com bubble and everything over in the States. Did it ever cross your mind to raise money and maybe just go after it straight away?
We did raise money at one stage. I'm a bit older than you, but there was a government scheme called the BES, which is the Business Expansion Scheme. I think it's got a new name these days. And it was a thing where friends and family could kind of get a tax write-down to put money. So we raised some funding through that, but not the kind of tens and hundreds of millions you see tech startups raising these days. I think maybe that's what was the, you know, not just trying to get it from, you know, an Irish company to a European company to go, no, we're going to be the biggest in the world, if you like. And I think that's where you need all that firepower. So that's possibly, you know, something that maybe should have done. But we did look and we did go, and, you know, at one stage we needed, you know, to scale out from where we were. That's always been one of the challenges, was everybody always wants a local recommendation. So you could be the biggest ticketing company in Germany, and then you try to cut a deal in France, and they'll say, well, who are you working with in France? Or you're working with someone in France, but that's a rugby team. What soccer teams are you working with? So always, to get to the next level, you always had to have a reference customer, or convince people to go with you, even though you don't have any reference customers. And that's where the funding kind of helped, because we were able to get in maybe a team of people. We hired a sales guy who had come to us from Ticketmaster, and where there was existing relationship, we were able to lean on relationship and use that to grow, I guess.
What is the difference between a ticket and a piece of paper? Like, what was it that Ticketmaster had at the time that other companies really couldn't compete with? What was your insight in terms of competing with them?
It's a very subtle difference, but I think it's quite important. Connor, if you were to set up the Connor Stadium or Connor FC, you would put your tickets on sale with Ticketmaster. But if you had worked with us, we just said, here's our software solution. You can sell the tickets yourselves on your own website. You know, you're answering the phone. So even though we were a ticketing company, the reality is we were actually a software provider of a system that allowed people to sell tickets. And they want, you know, at the time, there was a push to retain the relationship with the customer for repeat business. If you were a theater or something, and you've got some customers who come three times a year, you wanted to know who they were so you could reach out to them and tell them. Whereas with Ticketmaster, it's kind of a, they'll come in, Madonna is coming to town, she only comes once a year, she's on her European tour. So I think what Ticketmaster offered to this day is rock solid reliability at scale. Madonna doesn't need additional assistance with their marketing to sell out the venue. It's going to sell it anyway, but what she needs is reliability at scale. What we offered was a way to sell tickets, but also a platform that would help you to sell more tickets.
So I know you said earlier that you tried to do everything yourself until you could get the right people and everything else. Did you understand how to develop the software or how to build it or anything like that at the start?
No, I had no idea. Hired in, you know, recognized us about that. I suppose that's something I'm good at, is recognizing when I'm not good at something and just hiring in the right people. Initially, we actually hired a third-party company to build the platform, but then it needed ongoing maintenance, so we ended up, you know, hiring IT staff in-house. But no, I'm certainly not a programmer. Now, over the years, I've learned enough that I could kind of talk my way around it.
Was that the biggest challenge at the time, or was it growing the business from a customer acquisition point of view? What do you remember as being the biggest challenge in the early years?
Definitely the kind of the credibility piece at each time. It didn't matter. There are all these little mini verticals, you know, within the ticketing market. Like, there's theaters, there's sports, but then you might say, well, we've got a whole bunch of sports customers, but maybe it's more narrow than that. Maybe it's, have we got a whole bunch of GAA teams, or is it rugby teams, or is it baseball or basketball? I think that's true, you know, with scaling in any kind of a business at any level. You know, you could be a big, massive company with a global presence, but you might never have had maybe, I don't know, a government contract, you know, national defense or something like that. So they might say, you know, you could be an enormous company, but not have the relevant experience. And that's always been the thing with a combination of me being so young at the time, you know, like I remember going into the German market, the system wasn't available in German. You know, we had to translate it. So the challenge might have been, if you show us the system in German, we'll consider it then, but we're not going to take your word that you're going to translate it. Or so, yeah, there was always each new market or new vertical just had its own challenges that would delay growth or stop you from moving forward as quickly as you would like.
Were they well thought out plans for you and the people who are working with you? Or was it, you saw an opportunity in Germany, or you saw an opportunity in a particular vertical and decided to kind of plan it out and go for it? Or was it you just kind of picked up customers as you went along and then built on it from there?
It was always planned and targeted in terms of the verticals that we would target. But sometimes, in that business for a very long time, there'd be a bit of luck or a happy coincidence where make a made up example here. Let's say we were targeting theaters in the UK. And I know, for example, something happened. We ended up, for whatever reason, in North Wales, signing a whole bunch of customers. So then we made it a strategy. We had customer support people and implementation people, and they were always getting on flights from Dublin going to North Wales. And we were saying, why don't we make North Wales a strategy rather than theatres? So, you know, it would become that, and it might pivot and change based on a geography or based on a certain success in a certain sphere. But you know, there was always a very methodical planning. We'd always say, where are we now? We're working with Division 4 soccer teams. What would we need to do to get to Division 3? Where are we likely to sign the business? When we started, there was kind of Ticketmaster and very little else. These days, there are thousands and thousands of ticketing companies. So we would always evaluate the leads that we were talking to based on where we saw our strengths versus the competitors.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
Talk to me about hiring for a little bit. You said there again earlier that you wanted to keep things profitable and you always kind of thought about profit. Was it the case that you kind of waited until you got new customers and then brought new people in? Or did you come across this chicken and egg problem of hiring staff and then having to bring in the business to support them?
Chicken and egg is maybe a good example. We would sign the business, hope that we would be able to do it with the existing team. If not, we would hire in someone new. But looking back, if I could go back and say, I think if Jeff Bezos was running the company, he would have said, let's get 500 salespeople and hopefully they'll sign something. And, you know, he wouldn't have cared if it made or lost money because he would have been in that financial situation where I was always focused, we also need to keep paying salaries and things. And, you know, there's definitely been a couple of times over the years as well where we signed something maybe a little bit bigger than we were ready for and ended up making a mess of it because we didn't have, not necessarily the experience, but maybe the scale to deliver on some larger contracts that we got in. You know, I remember around 2008, 2009, taking on, we used to work with a team or with a theater, but then we started to sign like deals that were for league, you know, a league, like you're working with the ATP tour. So doing, you know, multiple different or Spanish basketball league where we were working with every basketball team in Spain. That was one contract, and it was a lot of manpower, and you needed people all over Spain arriving and doing implementations, and we were scrambling, and probably the service delivery wasn't as good as it could have been.
Did you have to fix that particular example or anything, or was it a matter of losing a client and learning the hard way?
You always lose clients. That's never stopped. But contract relationships were over a long term. There were 5 years or 7 years, and you would have time to repair things. I know we spent a long time hiring and focusing on kind of throwing flowers at the customer. What later became known as, now a common term, is a customer success manager, basically people who are working with the customer to keep them happy. That was a kind of a .com thing. Before that, it was just, we have a support phone number that you can call. This was more proactive, about being proactive and getting on site. So Yeah, I think with those long-term contracts, we realized the client wasn't happy because we had messed up and you needed to get them back on site. So we invested fairly heavily in what is now called customer success, or, you know, account managers, to make sure that our existing customers were being looked after.
Did the business mature from the point of view of having more structure on teams and things as you grew? Was it the case that you were saying, oh, we need now a director of sales, or now we need someone in this position, we'll just hire them? Or at any stage, was it more structured to the point where, you know, we have a board now plus these teams for marketing, sales, operations, and we'll just let them get on with it?
Definitely around in the sort of early 2010s, for a company being run, you know, essentially from Ireland, we were in a quite a dispersed geographic space. I spent a lot of time flying around the Middle East, Australia, New Zealand, you know, right around Europe. We have customers all over the world, and we needed to restructure it in a way where geographic teams that would manage the regions and, you know, setting up local offices in each region. And there's always a little bit of pushback from existing customers or potential customers from feeling like you're not local. Like we were working with the Royal Opera House in Muscat in Oman. You know, they asked, would we set up an office in Muscat? And we did. And we, you know, we ended up having 20 customers in Oman. And, you know, bizarrely, like a small company from Dublin going out to visit the Sultan of Oman, who runs all these venues. So we took a strategic decision to set up local offices in each, you know, in the let's call them region. It wasn't necessarily in every country, but that was a decision we had to take at the time. But mostly in terms of growth, going back to your original question, we would see an opportunity. Oh, look, these days we're needing more. Digital marketing was a big thing. We always had salespeople, but digital, you know, where you started to do Google AdWords, and you needed to be on Facebook, you need to have a whole digital presence. Others beat us to that punch, and we then, you know, we had to backfill and said, look, we're lacking in this department. Then as we scale up a bit, we start to notice maybe we need more on the bookkeeping side, or maybe on the accounts, and, you know, having to respond to what was happening in the business really was the main growth. But one key strategic decision was that, yeah, just the geographic layout of things.
What was your role in the business? You mentioned there that you were kind of flying all over the place. Was it sales? Was it customer success? Or was it kind of a bit of everything?
We always had department heads, and department heads would report into me. The reason for all the flying about was every time we have a customer, especially in the sports sphere, working with the New York Giants, and, you know, they're playing a home fixture against another team. If you can get out there and meet the client, but also meet the team they're playing against, it was kind of a sales, but it wasn't a sales opportunity. You know, it's more kind of like PR. So my role was to be, and, you know, to this day, it is in terms of, one, the public face of the company, but I think mainly vision is kind of my best strength, is vision of knowing what's coming next in the market, going to these places to see, well, look, what are they doing in New York in the ticketing market that they're not doing in Hereford? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what are they doing in Sydney? And being able to kind of take those concepts, similar to what I did with the ice rink, of taking the best bits of ice rinks from all over the world and putting them together. I would say I had to give myself a job title. It was sort of software architect, you know, if you like, alongside public relations, and then in the background managing teams.
So when you would come back from maybe seeing something, or you wanted to kind of implement something that was happening elsewhere, or you had a vision for something, what way were those things implemented? Did you have kind of monthly management meetings and things like that, where these things would be discussed, or was there any kind of process or structure around that?
Yeah, there was always in-house. We'd had different sets of meetings depending on the teams, daily, weekly, and monthly for various teams. Like engineering is quite, you've probably heard of the Scrum process. That's where all the engineers get together every morning, and they'd have a Scrum meeting. And it's not really checking off a to-do list. It's more saying, if we did this, what would that impact be on other parts of the system? So that would be a thing which was weekly, then, or sorry, that was daily. Then there was weekly meetings for, say, you know, marketing teams, sales teams, and then monthly meetings. We do kind of what, again, over the years, the terms have changed. It's probably called an all hands meeting now, where, you know, everybody got together once a month. And then we also had a lot of people in quite spread out, as I said, geographically. Once a quarter, we would try and bring it. We would go to a client site, whether it was, I don't know, the Kentucky Derby, or it was a football match, and we'd pick something that was topical and of interest and meet with all of the team and get everybody together. And in those sessions, we'd do a sort of the big picture brainstorming for what do we want to achieve in 5 years. So there was, depending on the nature of the meetings, there was daily, weekly, monthly, and quarterly things, the quarterly being the bigger ones with everybody.
Did you ever have anyone you kind of took advice from or anything over the years? I know you said you were quite young when you started the business. Was there any mentors or chair people or anything like that in the business that helped you specifically?
We've kind of some very experienced shareholders. They kind of make up our board. And I guess, you know, with age, you get a bit more confident. But earlier in the growth process, I would have leaned on the shareholders team. You know, they're you know, these are kind of people older than me, more experienced, and lean on them. We've also tried over the years, you know, different advisory firms, whether it was legal practices or, you know, I'm sure most companies outsource a lot of those functions. You know, they're the accountancy, the legal, and we've hired in some third party advisory. I think it's always a good idea as well to get an independent audit done. Like, sometimes if I wanted to make a point to the board, you know, at one point we wanted to make sure our technology was as good as it needed to be, so we got there's an Irish company called Nearform. We got them. They're actually the company that they're out of Waterford, but they've just done the COVID app for the government. And they do, you know, analyses. So, you know, we would on occasion get independent audits and advisory services in. I do think that's important to kind of recognize that you don't know everything, to lean sometimes on that experience. You know, sometimes there's been certain times where I've gone, oh, I had a gut feeling I should have done something, and someone told me not to, and I should have backed myself. And then sometimes it's the other way around, and you say, I was told what to do, and I didn't do it.
Yeah. Would that have been from, I suppose, more experienced people or something like that when you were kind of younger? It was kind of easier to take their advice than not at the time?
It's probably easier to take advice now when I need it less. You think you know everything when you're young.
Was there ever a big growth spurt in the company, or did it kind of happen just gradually over the years?
Growth was always pretty steady. There was two kind of stages where not only was there growth spurts, but there was I don't know what the opposite of growth spurt is, but we hemorrhaged, you know, we're like, oh God, we're after, you know, losing a bunch of customers, and how did that happen and what are we doing wrong? But I think over the longer term, you start to see them as patterns. Getting a new ticketing system is a bit like getting a car. It's something you're going to own for 5 years, and there might be nothing wrong with your old car, but when the time comes to change, you just want to change. And sometimes you lose business through no fault of your own. It's just things have run their course. So major growth spurts would have been just, it's really down to luck. You know, the sales is kind of a drip feed game, where you have a whole sales pipeline and you're working on what's coming in, and you know, sometimes there's nothing. It's like the buses, sometimes there's nothing for ages, and then you get three buses all together at the same time, and sometimes that would happen. You go, whoa, we've just taken on a whole bunch of business, we need to scale quickly. And then sometimes you're going, oh well, we've had a bit of a bad run on, maybe we need to scale things back a bit. But I think those issues wouldn't have been an issue, or wouldn't be challenges, if you had taken in the really big investment earlier and you had enough slack within the business that whether you went up or down, it didn't really matter.
Did you ever get worried during those times when you were kind of losing customers? Was your kind of own personal income ever under pressure at any stage?
I don't think that you always worry, but you always check in. Because the business has always been profitable, I would always run with, say, 6 months or a year's cash flow, so that you have that cushion there and always put it aside. And I think as you grow out of business, you know, like, look, we've just had COVID. I don't think anyone ever planned for the worldwide economy to shut down for a year and a half. And I think it's because of prudent financial planning that we've had a strong enough balance sheet that we've been able to get through something like that. I know a whole bunch of our competitors have gone to the wall during this time. So I think in answer to the original question, you worry, but because of the worry, you build up a cushion to help you stop worrying. But if you do start to dig into that cushion, that worry could come back. And, you know, that was the thing we had to look at for COVID is, you know, it's easy to make a plan when you know what you're trying to do, but it's very difficult to make a plan in COVID when we don't have any facts. If no one knew how long it was going to last or, you know, what the impact of it was, and it was different by jurisdiction. With us having customers right out globally, it had a different impact on different markets. You know, if you're in a nightclub in Wuhan today, you're probably open. If you're in Miami, you're open. But if you're in O'Connell Street, you're not allowed open. So it's dynamic and it's difficult to manage.
You strike me as someone that understands the business very well in pretty much all areas and what makes it tick and so on and so forth. Even going into like reasonably technical areas such as cash flow, financial planning on the technical side, the software side and everything else. Were those things, did you just pick them up along the way? Do you kind of gravitate just towards it naturally? Do you pick these things up with relative ease? Can you remember having to kind of learn things as you went along, or was it just this is common sense and I kind of get it?
I think it's a little from column A, a little from column B. When you have teams of people in an office, you overhear everything, and you begin to see patterns over time. Like if you have a bunch of salespeople and certain types of deals keep coming through and certain ones don't, and they're talking in a language, you start to pick up on that language. Same with engineering. As I said, I'm not a programmer, but when you hear about Jira or Bitbucket or you hear about bugs and fixes and all these words start to become commonplace, you pick up some of it. But I've never like gone and educated myself, if you like, in a particular space and gone and taken a course in programming or sales or business leadership or those kind of things. But I do feel doesn't matter what size you get to, I think it's really important that somebody in the business understands all of the different parts. And we did the same where we rotate people's jobs. So the accounting team would work in marketing for a day and vice versa, so that they could either give just a different perspective on how the thing should be run, or at least you're de-risking it that if certain people left, you wouldn't be left. I know I'm harping back to COVID, but during COVID, we've had a lot of staff furloughed and, you know, it's going, well, who knows how to do everything when there's no people here. This was 20 years ago when you first start out a business. You're doing everything yourself. There is no departments or divisions. You are the accounting department. You are the marketing department, sales department, everything else. So you have to figure out and learn them. And it's only then the thing's built up on top of whatever you set up originally. So
can you remember, even in one of those areas, sales, marketing, engineering, can you remember hiring people for the first time in those areas? And how did you know what you were looking for as such? Was it, I just need someone to take over kind of what I was doing here? Or did you get kind of advice in that respect? And then I suppose subsequently, when those people were hired and you were kind of learning from them, was that intentional? Had you hired people that were kind of much more experienced or kind of smarter than you in those particular areas?
I did a lot of hiring, what I would have called gray hair. I have the gray hair myself now, but going into meetings with companies that are bigger than you, I always felt I wanted someone who was older and more experienced and had worked on those kind of accounts. And that doesn't just mean that, you know, the sales is a customer facing thing, but with a back end problem like an engineering thing or looking at a PR issue or something to do with HR, you need, I think, people that have dealt with, you know, people that have come from an organization that's much bigger than yours, where they've dealt with the small problems you're having at scale, so that when you do put in a new, it's all, you know, the business is really a game of systems, and you're building systems and processes, that you need to make sure that when you're building your process, it's not flawed to begin with, where, you know, it's not going to end up being able to scale out to the size of an Apple or an IBM or something.
Was it hard to find gray hair, or was it hard to convince them to come on board?
I think it was nearly endearing. The product has always been excellent. And I think you need that balance of sort of youth and gray hair. I know we've had people over the years where they maybe didn't have knowledge of some of the younger technologies, but they were very good at whatever role they were doing. And I think you need, I might have been saying, you know, I remember APIs first came out and you started to be able to integrate products together. I know you do a lot of stuff at Xero with integrating things together. But some, as you said, the people with the gray hair might know what an integration was. But then if I can kind of go, look how much time we could save if we could do this. So I think people weren't joining the company because of me. They were joining, I think, because of the product and what we were doing. But I think there was a good kind of a vibe, if you like, in terms of, like, we people of all ages and all backgrounds. And I think that helps, even just seeing cultural differences between how things are done in different countries. In the Middle East, you don't buy a ticket, you buy a thing like the buy a Netflix subscription. You pay monthly and you can go do what you want to do. And that's very different how we do things here. And I think, yeah, that you've seen your demographic worked. But no, I didn't really have difficulties getting people to come work for us. Looking back, I can, maybe there should have been, but I don't know, I'm pretty charming.
So Float is like a reasonable size business at this stage. What do you think makes it a good business to own?
I think, you know, people may not know who are listening, if you like. What Float is trying to do is, we specifically work with sports teams, and what we're trying to do is to help them to do three things. Number one is to increase their spend per fan. So if Connor goes to a Manchester United game, does he spend £25 sterling or does he spend 36? We give you tools to drive that number up too. We give tools to the organization to help what we call driving fan frequency. So that means Connor goes to 7 games a year, but we want him to go to 10 games a year. Excuse me. And finally, how do we attract new fans? So there's a lot of repeat business in sports where Connor goes to every home game, but it's rare a new person comes along. So we have tools to do that. But in order to do that, what we are having to do is to bring together multiple systems. So every team in the world will have about 7 or 8 pieces of software to run their business. They'll have a marketing platform. They'll have an e-commerce platform. They'll have a ticketing system, CRM, accounting, and so on. And what's interesting, or you know, going back to your core question, what's interesting with Float is we're providing a kind of a one-stop shop for everything that does all of those things that other people are doing by integrating those other systems together. But because we're doing that, I think it's the first time we can genuinely say to a customer that it's almost like we become consultants working for the company. Like, a lot of football teams are run by ex-footballers, not necessarily business people. Theaters are run by ex-actors and so on. If you can drive this, what I said, the spend per fan up by $10, and you can get Connor to come the extra 3 times, the team is making more money. But what it also happens is, you're improving this buzzword at the moment in the industry called the fan experience. The fan experience is about what they call the customer journey. So let's just say you're going to a Manchester United soccer game, and your journey might start when you park in the car park. Then you have your ticket, you scan your ticket. Maybe you buy a jersey in the club store. Maybe you have a hot dog and some French fries. Then you have a beer. Then you decide you're going to upgrade your seat because you want a VIP suite so that you've got a big screen TV because it's raining. And throughout what I've just described there, you probably spent £225 sterling, but that consisted of 7 transactions across 7 different systems. And none of those systems know, they know how many hamburgers were sold, but they don't know, did Connor buy a hamburger or was it Hugh that bought the hamburger? So we're able to give it to clients that, number one, helps them essentially generate more revenues, but it also improves the fan experience because Connor has a better time at the game, and we're essentially changing the game day experience from you're not going to a football match anymore, you're going to a casino in Las Vegas. You know, it's a day out for the family. There might be a kid zone, there might be a concert on afterwards, and there's a shopping experience and whole manner of activities. So I like sport and going to these events, and that's a good space to be in. But for our clients, but I think we're adding value for our clients' clients, as in those people who buy tickets for those events, they're having a better time. So all the self-help books you can ever read will tell you that you need to add value to people. And I feel like we're actually doing that, whereas in the past, I just thought we were giving a good service, but maybe not adding value.
So not to put words in your mouth, but it's an advantage if you can kind of help your clients to make more money ultimately.
Well, the more, that's what I always say to them. If we're ever in a sales meeting, the more money you make, the more money we make. The more, also, the more they use the platform. Like, you know, let's say in the stadium, there's, I don't know, 7 merchandise stores and 3 hamburger joints, and maybe there's a gambling. The gambling is becoming a very big thing in the US at the moment. They're using Float for 7 of the 10 parts of the stadium. The more they use it for, you know, again, the better they do, the better we do. So, yeah, no, it is an advantage. And there's nobody else right now doing exactly what we're doing, but everybody, but we're not doing anything new. We don't, it's just that we're doing it all together in the one system. And to do what I've just described to you, that to manage that customer journey so that we would allow, in my example of your Manchester United thing, Man United could use Float to build their app. So you would have the Man United app, which is built on Float. You buy your ticket, and your ticket is your whole customer journey. You scan it at the car park. You use it to pay for your jersey when you buy it. You then scan it. Just like in Starbucks or something, if you're a loyalty card from Starbucks, you scan that when you're buying the hamburger. Or if you've probably seen an example everybody could relate to is when you're in the airport. You've got your boarding pass and you're buying a magazine in Boots. They'll always make you scan your boarding card. But by doing that, they know that Hugh bought whatever magazine he bought in Boots. So we would do the same thing at a stadium. You scan the Man United app, and we know that you bought French fry, you know, that you drink beer in the summer and wine in the winter. And all. So the amount of data that we would have about an organization and their customer profiles, it really allows us to do an awful lot of automation and to drive all those metrics that we've been talking about.
You mentioned there briefly about self-help books. Do you read business books, or have you drawn from books and resources in terms of getting ideas for the business as you've grown?
Yeah, I've always read a whole bunch of like businessy ones and stuff, kind of Tony Robbins and that kind of stuff. But what you've noticed over the years is as more of them come out, they all say the same thing. So I have done. I think he's great, actually, Tony Robbins, if you're to read any of them.
But less and less maybe now.
I don't know if this is that I have a short attention span, but I like everything summarized. And I found this site, 4minutebooks.com, which is basically some bunch of guys, and they've gone and read all these books and summarized them down. It's like a one-page summary. I like stuff in condensed format now, so I'm not reading what you were talking about there, the long form. I'm not reading it, which is funny when you think about there seems to be a lot more uptake in long form content. If you look at, we all go on the likes of Netflix now and streaming services, and we'll watch 7 seasons of The Sopranos or something, which, you know, you're investing half your bloody life watching a television show, but, you know, we can't sit down for an hour to read a book.
So what does the future look like for yourself and for the business? How do you see things progressing over the next few years?
Our growth market is all about the US. That's right before COVID, we were growing really rapidly in the US. Things did slow down a little bit with COVID, but we're now ramping up again. We're bringing everybody back to work. Our focus is just to scale the business in the US. And my role has changed a little bit over the last few years, where I've moved into a role, an M&A type role, where you can only grow so fast through organic growth by signing up new customers. And the real way we've grown a little bit recently is in making complementary company. So like, let's say, oh, we felt we weren't weak in the marketing space, we might acquire a marketing application and then we put it into our incubator where we'll kind of work out the kinks in that product and then we'll merge that product into the Float product. So even though for nearly 20 years I've been CEO of a ticketing company, it's like because of COVID, I've ended up now being the CEO of a private equity firm. And I have no experience in private equity, which I kind of like. The future is growth into the US, but not the same kind of growth we've had up to now. Growth by acquisition, growth by merger, growth by strategic partnership. I'm starting to take a step very much out of the day-to-day operations of the business and just focus on that long-term strategic stuff.
Are you enjoying that aspect of it?
Yes. Anyone who knows me would tell you I'm very much an ideas person and I'm very social, which is why I found COVID actually quite difficult, not being able to talk to people. But if you're going to buy a business, you've got to go and meet the other business owners who are going to naturally be like-minded people like you if they're in a similar space. You can shoot the breeze about the ideas and big picture. I like big picture. I think that's probably common of all entrepreneurs that kind of you're dealing with people in JetBooks, you know, and I'm sure most entrepreneurs just want the accounts done, but they don't care about the detail. Big picture stuff is much more enjoyable to me than the kind of the day-to-day operations. I've done that for a long time. There's more interesting travel as well. Like I can see maybe a move to the US on the cards if they ever drop this travel restriction and let us in. We have been spending a lot of time in the US prior to COVID. Just before it kicked off, we'd spent 3-4 months in Florida, kind of a growth area for us. Opportunity to see the world as well. So.
I wish you the very best of luck with that and continued success with the business. Hugh Moron, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks very much, Connor, and best of luck to you as well. Thanks for having me.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.